This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, making critical biblical scholarship accessible and fun. Hey everyone, welcome to Not Your Grandma's Bible Study.
I'm not your grandma.
Neither am I. I'm Jill.
I'm Zach.
Dr. Jill.
But not Dr. Zach.
Close enough.
Getting there.
You're going to be Doc Poppin', though.
I'll be Doc Pop eventually.
Doc Poppin'.
Doc Pop eventually, but not yet.
All right. Well, this episode, we will talk about Miriam.
Miriam.
It occurred to us. We haven't talked about Miriam yet, and she's a big dadgum deal.
Very big deal.
So, we're going to take a little bit of time to talk about the different portrayals of Miriam throughout the biblical text, as well as a little bit of the extra biblical tradition that developed around her. Yeah, so we will just kind of dive into a couple of key texts that talk about her.
Yeah.
And see how this discussion progresses. So
sounds good.
The first sort of aspect of Miriam's character that I think we should talk about, I think would be fun, is Miriam the protector, in part because this is the first text that she's brought up in. Chronologically, this also makes sense.
Right.
Miriam the protector. So for this one, we're going to look at Exodus 2. If you'll turn in your Bibles with us to Exodus 2. That is the second book in your Bible after Genesis, before Leviticus. Or as a child I used to babysit calls it, Leviticus. Leviticus and Deuteronomy.
Close enough.
Close enough.
Close enough.
I actually like Leviticus better, personally.
Leviticus. Leviticus.
I cannot. I have to think every time I say it now. Leviticus. Okay, so first we'll talk about Miriam as Miriam the protector. And so in this Exodus 2 story, many of you will be familiar. This is the story that often is more about Moses being put in the Nile to protect him from the slaughter that Pharaoh has commanded. So Pharaoh's decided that there are too many Hebrews, and they're going to realize that there are too many of them and that they can outnumber them and overpower them. And so he decides that every boy born to the Hebrews needs to be thrown into the Nile, but every girl can live. So a man from the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. She conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine baby, she hid him for 3 months, as long as she could, which is crazy because I feel like babies that young do nothing but cry. Maybe I'm wrong. But when she decides she can't hide him any longer, she puts him in a papyrus basket. She plasters it with bitumen and pitch. She puts the kid in it and she places the basket among the reeds in the riverbank. And Miriam, his sister, stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. And so when she puts Moses in the water, and she sees that the daughter of Pharaoh has come down to the river, sees the baby in the basket, decides to raise the child as her own, which is, I think, an interesting decision that this daughter makes at all, instead of just being like, because she says, this must be one of the Hebrews' children, and then decides to raise it instead of following daddy's orders.
I'm going to take it.
I want it. And so Miriam then goes and secures a wet nurse, because she's obviously the Pharaoh's daughter can't nurse this child.
Yep.
She's not had the child. So Miriam's like, I got you, and goes and gets Moses' mom, and Moses' mom actually gets to nurse Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Although throughout this, Miriam is not named, but
it's Miriam. Virtually assumed that it's Miriam.
Unless there's some other unknown sister to Moses.
Which we'll get to.
What? My mind just got blown, guys. Okay, so Miriam here, as sort of a protector of Moses, she really secures a wet nurse, so she secures survival for Moses here. And I think it's interesting that she doesn't wait for the Pharaoh's daughter to speak to really ask for, you know, how am I going to take care of this child I just said I want?
Yeah.
Miriam steps up and says, should I go get you a wet nurse from among the Hebrew women?
Mm-hmm.
So she negotiates her brother's life, his adoption, and care with a woman who literally could have had her killed alongside this baby.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really bold move that she makes here. As a child, you know, I mean, at least old enough to be speaking confidently, but I would say no younger than maybe 5, probably a little older, but
probably between 5 and 7.
Hard to know.
Yeah.
So I think that that's a really interesting portrayal of her very early on as, and this whole passage here is just full of women protectors, which I think is fascinating. But yeah, so I think this is a really cool portrayal of her as a protector of her brother. What are your thoughts on this passage?
Yeah, I think it's also in talking about, this is an exclusively woman-based passage. Mm-hmm. I mean, Moses is present, but he's a baby and not a speaking, acting character here. But so you mentioned the fact that the princess, Pharaoh's daughter, is working directly against the edict, the decree to kill. So we have this negotiation of power between women. And so we have a woman in power, a woman who doesn't have power, Miriam, and they're actually subverting a death-dealing system in that moment. Whether Pharaoh's daughter meant to, or what's all going, what her motivation was, obviously probably somewhat selfish because she wanted a kid. So not sure about her, but the fact that Miriam not only steps out boldly, but now we've got this interaction and power play between two women that is subverting a system.
Now 2:6 says that the princess saw that he was crying and she took pity on him. So there really could be an element of just instinctual concern for another human being, that it might indicate to some extent she recognizes the injustice of
what's going on.
The Pharaoh has decreed now that she's confronted with
suffering.
a real life victim of this decree.
I think
that's a bit relevant to lots of things in our life. Like we can ignore injustice pretty easily until it's on our doorstep.
Yes.
I think there might be some really good preaching parallels available here. I don't know. Because I think that it is easy to, I hear a lot of folks who are, these refugees better come the right way, blah, 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 things like that. But they're also the exact same people who, if they knew a refugee family had moved to their city, heard that individual story, would be the first bringing over a casserole. You know what I mean?
They
would be the first going through their closets and saying, I don't wear this. This will fit her. This will fit him. And so I think sort of the self-reflection of what sort of meta level of injustice do I let happen when I would never let that happen if I had eyes on it and knew the story. So maybe that's something to be taken away here, but that got a little preachy. Sorry. I just turned into your grandma. Wash your hands.
Eat your food.
Eat your vegetables. Another aspect of this, and this is extra textual or extra biblical rather, in Pseudophilo, which is often referred to as the LAB, Latin antiquitas something or other. The Pseudophilo. This is a text that was written around 135 to 130 BCE. And in this version of the story, Miriam prophesies over Moses. It says, and the Spirit of God came upon Miriam one night, and she saw a dream and told it to her parents in the morning, saying, I have seen this night, and behold, a man in linen garments stood and said to me, go and say to your parent. There's a lot of quotes within quotes. Go and say to your parent, behold, he who will be born to you, born from you, will be cast forth into the water. Likewise, through him, the water will be dried up. And I will work signs through him and save my people, and he will exercise leadership always. And when Miriam told of her dream, her parents did not believe her. And so we can at least see here by the 130s BCE, this unnamed sister in Exodus is Miriam. That's tradition's already come up there. But I think it's interesting that Miriam is given a prophecy that her parents do not believe. So she's really being shown here as wise and powerful beyond her years. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's prophesying at a young age. She's negotiating with a princess at a young age. And then there's another little story in Jubilees, which is a text from 160 to 140 BCE, somewhere in that window. And part of that story includes Miriam standing guard Moses in the basket, protecting him from the birds that are trying to get to him.
Mm-hmm.
So in that, another instance of another example, and I think that's just an interesting story. I think birds might be something in Jubilees. I don't know.
Probably.
Cause it's such a weird addition, I think, to the story. I mean, it makes sense. Birds are douche canoes, so they can be. So anyway, Miriam as a protector, I think, is a really important aspect to the tradition of Miriam that should be acknowledged. She's very protective of her brother. A second aspect to talk about. Yeah. Do you have anything further on Miriam the Protector?
No.
Okay. Miriam the Prophetess. Mm-hmm. So for this one, we're going to look at Exodus 15. So if you'll just jump ahead about 13 chapters from where you're at. This is Miriam's song at the sea. And so you want to talk a little bit about Will Gaffney. We've mentioned this book before, Daughters of Miriam. Mm-hmm. We'll talk a little bit about that. Women prophets in ancient Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So this is, I'm pulling almost everything I'm going to say out of this book by Dr. Gaffney. What do you want me to say about it?
you can just talk a little bit about what Will Gaffney is arguing that prophetic activity included, maybe.
Sure. Okay. Sure. Yeah, one thing I want to point out is we mentioned on the Hannah episode that prophetic activity can be much wider and broader than people assume. People right. think visions, directly talking to God, foretelling the future, miracles. That's kind of what constitutes it, and usually only men.
Right.
Huldah gets a mention. So Gaffney writes in Daughters of Miriam, these are all prophetic activities. Engaging in an intercessory prayer, dancing, drumming, singing, teaching, and interpreting Torah, which is God's revelation, legal material, sociocultural expectations, and more. Delivering oracles on behalf of God, sometimes in ecstasy or occasionally demonstratively. Resolving disputes, working wonders, determining when to go to war, mustering troops and fighting battles, archiving their oracles in writing, and experiencing visions. And another thing, I don't think it's in that list, but musical performances.
Right. One of the things that she, the way that she delineates this list is by looking at the male prophets.
Yes.
The ones that nobody's arguing if they're prophets or not.
Yes.
So correct. She looks at the different activities that these men are engaged in, and it's this crazy long list here. Singing's in the list. It's at the very beginning.
Okay, singing was in there, yeah.
Yeah. And then she looks and says, hey, here are a bunch of women doing those exact same things. Mm-hmm. And so her argument here is, if it's literally just the things that they're doing, then there are a whole lot more prophets running around this Bible than we've noted before. And a lot of them are women, of them. So,
yep. So in Exodus 15, Miriam is described as singer, dancer, and percussionist. Mm-hmm. And so Gaffney also points out that, so if you want an example of where musical performances, especially when there are percussive instruments, are identified as prophetic performances, 1 Samuel 10 and 1 Chronicles 25. So in 1 Samuel, the members of the prophetic guild play the harp, hand drums, flute, and lyre while they prophesy. And in 1 Chronicles, the children of Asaph, Heman, and Jeduthun prophesy with lyres, harps, and cymbals in the worship system organized by David. So yeah, so Exodus 15 is really interesting in that regard, that it is the first moment that we have, and it's actually, Exodus 15 is fairly widely regarded as one of the oldest pieces of Hebrew
right.
we have in the entire Bible.
Yeah, and so what I think is interesting here about Exodus 15, her song, you're right, like I've heard that linguistically and just how it's written, it seems to be one of the oldest, at least traditions, that's made it through, is her song specifically. And her song is in 15... 21.
Yes.
15:20 says, then the prophet, Miriam, she does get called a prophet.
Aaron's
sister took a tambourine in her hand, percussion, and all of the women went out after her with tambourines and with dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And Miriam sang to them, sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider, he is thrown into the sea. Prior to that, Moses gets a real long song. So I grew up in this church in Kansas, Liberal Kansas, shout out to Faith Tabernacle. And the pastor of the church, when my parents were there, he wrote a song, wrote some music to this, and like, I cannot hear this without wanting to sing. I will sing unto the Lord, for he is triumphed gloriously. Horse and the rider thrown into the sea. I loved that song when I was a kid. Loved it. If you're interested in hearing the whole thing, just let me know.
We'll
do a little bonus episode of me singing some old songs from the church I grew up in. Yeah, so this Exodus 15, it really demonstrates here that it calls her a prophet, and that this song of celebration, not a foretelling, but a song of celebration mm-hmm. in the moment is a prophetic act. And I think that's really important mm-hmm. For what prophecy is, but also for who Miriam is.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have anything else you wanted to add about Exodus or prophecy before we move on to 4Q?
Yeah, no, I'm good on Exodus.
4Q 365, which is a scroll that was discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls. 4Q. Q stands for Qumran, because mm-hmm. that's the name of the compound where all this is found. Compound. The area, whatever you want to call it. 4, there are 11 caves where scrolls were discovered. 4 is the fourth cave.
Fourth cave.
So fourth cave at Qumran, scroll number 365.
Yep.
So pretty straightforward numbering yep. system once you know what you're looking at here. Or 365th scroll that was cataloged
yes.
within this cave. Not yes. necessarily. It might have been the first one they pulled out. Who knows?
Yeah.
So this scroll fragment here contains an extended song of Miriam. Mm. So Exodus 15 just mm-hmm. has the two lines. But in 4Q 365, it reads, "I will sing to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, God, for he has triumphed gloriously. Yah is my strength and might. You are great, delivering your people. The enemy's hope has perished and his memory is forgotten. Your enemies perished in the mighty waters. Your people will exalt you to the heights, for you gave a covenant to our fathers, the one doing glorious things." This roots her covenant relationship, or the roots of this are in her covenant relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps the Noahic covenant that is found in Genesis 9, or maybe the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 15. Or it could anachronistically mm-hmm. be a reference to what's going to happen in Exodus 20 with the Mosaic covenant. But the biggest point I think to make here about Miriam and this prophetess role is that her leadership is presented without introduction mm-hmm. and without credentials. It is assumed. Nobody's questioning that Miriam is a leader.
Yep.
And I think that is very important, very important about a woman in Hebrew scriptures.
Yep.
Especially when she's not a military victor. Like the other women who are sort of given these prominent roles tend to be doing masculine things,
mm-hmm.
killing men in battle or in some sort of secret battle. So women, and we can talk about this in another episode, which would be interesting. Women who become powerful are becoming powerful because they're acting masculine.
Right.
They're acting like men. And Miriam's not doing anything particularly manly.
No.
She's fulfilling some pretty niche roles for women, protecting a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Singing and dancing are predominantly women's roles. So mm-hmm. I think that it's really interesting that she's a leader and there's no question about that. And she's not acting particularly masculinely within these roles. So
mm-hmm.
Just an observation I have. Yeah. So we're going to jump ahead now to Numbers. The book of Numbers.
Numbers.
That's after Leviticus and before Deuteronomy. Numbers 12. This story is really, really interesting. So in it, Miriam and Aaron confront Moses. And the text here, 12:1, says Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married,
mm-hmm.
for he had indeed married a Cushite woman, which sounds yep. so gossipy.
Yeah.
So they confront him because he married this Cushite woman, and he had really married this Cushite woman. Anyway, they say, "Has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?"
Mm-hmm.
And the Lord heard it.
He really heard it.
12:3. "Now the man Moses was very humble, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth." And this is fantastic to me because the tradition is Moses wrote this.
Yeah.
So Moses
is the most humble.
I am the most humble.
I am
more humble than literally anybody on earth. Okay. So anyway, I just think that's funny. So God overhears this confrontation, and he makes it perfectly clear that God and Moses have a special relationship in verses 6-8.
Mm-hmm.
And though angry with both Aaron and Miriam, God proceeds to punish only Miriam with leprosy.
Yep.
And that's in 12:9-10.
Yep.
"So the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed. When a cloud went away from over the tent, Miriam had become leprous, as mm-hmm. white as snow. And Aaron turned to Miriam and saw that she was leprous. So Aaron is not physically punished.
Right.
And Miriam is, even though it's very clear that the anger of the Lord was kindled against them. So that's important to see how this text can note that the men are in trouble too, but only the women have to get punished.
Yep.
Which is a little problematic for me. So Aaron then appeals to Moses, not to God, on behalf of Miriam in 12:11 and 12, calling Moses my Lord. Do not punish us for a sin that we have so foolishly committed. As if, I mean, Moses isn't the one who put the plague on her. God is. So then Moses then goes and appeals to God. Oh God, please heal her, in 12:13. And God has Miriam quarantined from the camp for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe Moses. I don't think it says explicitly who. It just says, so Miriam.
Yeah.
No, it's God. God says to Moses, let her be shut out of the camp for 7 days.
Yep.
But the Israelite camp, however, did not set out on the march until Miriam had been brought in again. Yeah. I think this is really interesting, right?
It is.
God punishes Miriam, and Aaron immediately goes to Miriam's defense. Maybe he's recognizing and acquiescing to Moses' divinely established role as mediator, but Aaron pleads to Moses to intervene for Miriam as opposed to just going straight to God. Aaron is high priest, the first of the priests, and he's going to Moses rather than to God when he is literally the gateway to God.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of interesting things going on here. Baruch Levine reads the verb, reads that verb. it's not pointed. I can't remember my Hebrew letters.
Za'ak, probably.
Za'ak, okay. Baruch Levine reads the verb za'ak, saying that it expresses the language of prayer, which I think is the verb for heal here, conveying an appeal to God by one in pain. So this indicates that Moses was not merely playing mediator and passing along Aaron's request to God. Moses' request was itself born out of pain, possibly from seeing his sister suffering and the Israelites potentially losing a leader. So not only do Aaron and Moses intercede for her healing, but the people don't move forward without her. Dennis Olson, in his New Interpreter Study Bible entry for Numbers here, writes that her authority is demonstrated by the people's waiting for her to be reinstated into the community before continuing on the march. So, though God might have it out for Miriam in this passage, Aaron, Moses, and the Israelites are firmly on her side. And I should note, I'm of the opinion that God is an absolute maniac in Numbers.
Oh, yeah.
God is portrayed as very punishy. You disagree with Moses, leprosy. You disagree with Moses, I'm going to open up this earth and swallow you whole.
Yep. Totally.
God is putting up with nothing. God is a parent dealing with a 2-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
Hard boundaries, ridiculous consequences. So anyway, this tradition is really, really, this story is really interesting. I mean, it's again, evidence of Miriam as a leader of the Israelites, so much recognized as such, so much so that the Israelites don't want to lose her.
Right.
They recognize, and again, as a woman, like this is just not common. They have Aaron and they have Moses. They need Miriam. They do not want to go on without her. I think that's just really fascinating.
I mean, and there's the fact that Miriam is in verse 2 claiming that Aaron and herself stand on equal prophetic ground as well, because it says, and they asked, does God, he in the text, not also speak through us?
Right.
And so even though Moses gets the archetype, you know, proto-prophet, can't do anything wrong, most humble in the world.
Humblest.
But it's very clear that, and Gaffney even argues that, so let's see, that Miriam being listed first. So in verse 1, she spoke, Miriam and Aaron. She takes that to mean, so some commentators have said, well, this is about guilt because it was Miriam who was punished. But Gaffney reads this as a heavily redacted story that actually guilt was probably initially on both Aaron and Miriam, but then later was shifted to the woman. But it was preserved in the sense that Miriam is listed first because of actually standing in the community, probably. You're always going to list the prominent, most important things first, especially when you're dealing with people.
Right.
So not only the fact that the community would not budge until Miriam was with them, but also the fact that Miriam was directly challenging and standing up and saying, you're not the only one God speaks through. Yeah. God speaks through me and God speaks through Aaron. And that's a direct claim. She's not called a prophet here, mm-hmm. but that's a direct claim on her part saying, no, I am yeah. a prophet. I do the yeah. same thing you do.
What's so different?
Yeah.
No, there's an extra biblical tradition around this story as well. I don't remember where it's from. I didn't write it down. It may just have been collected in Ginsberg's Legends of the Jews, because he compiles lots of different extra biblical traditions. So one of the things to note, some traditions have Miriam as a married woman. Some traditions don't. Mm-hmm. But that really falls outside the parameters of what we're talking about here. So, but this, with this tradition, Zipporah, Moses's wife, tells Miriam that because Moses was chosen to receive divine revelation, he has abstained from sexual relations with her.
Mm.
However, neither Miriam nor Aaron, nor any of the fathers for that matter, were obligated to abstain because they were chosen for revelation, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So there's not any tradition where men can't be married and be a man of God. That's, I think, like uniquely Catholic, right? So
yeah.
Miriam and Aaron then decide that Moses doing this must be out of pride,
right?
So like the biblical narrative, the text then goes on to goes to extraordinary lengths to defend Moses' position. God's wrath is kindled against Aaron and Miriam takes the brunt of the punishment. Interestingly, Aaron and Moses defend Miriam. Defense of Miriam is extended in this extra biblical tradition. Aaron appeals to Moses by recalling that Miriam has, by recalling all that Miriam has done as their co-leader. Moses does not need convincing because Moses has determined as soon as his sister became diseased, to intercede for her before God. So Moses draws a circle around himself and tells God that he will not move from it until God has healed Miriam.
Mm-hmm.
And further, if God will not heal Miriam, Moses says that he will do it himself. God agrees to heal Miriam. She's quarantined for a week. And as in the biblical narrative, the Israelites wait for her return before moving mm-hmm. forward. That's a really interesting extra biblical tradition. There's a tradition where Aaron and Moses are essentially saying, God, you are acting unjustly towards Miriam. And if you're not going to do what we need you to do, then we'll do it ourselves.
Yeah.
And God caves.
Yeah.
Really interesting mm-hmm. understandings of who God is and how humans and God can interrelate. Not uncommon. I think we see a little bit of that in Abraham's negotiation for Lot.
Sure. Yeah.
With Sodom and Gomorrah, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if there are 100 good people,
yep.
would you spare? And God's like, well, yeah.
Sure.
Okay, well, what if there are 50? Sure.
I guess.
And he gets, like, what if there's just one? I mean, I don't think yeah. he gets that low. But, like, this negotiation with God to get what you want in really demanding and pushy ways, not mm-hmm. penitent, not begging, but, like, if you don't do it, then I will.
Yeah.
Like, somebody's going to heal Miriam, so get on board or get out of the station kind of thing. Yeah. So. And finally, let's just talk a little bit about some biblical remembrances of her.
Yeah.
So Miriam, she's accounted for in 3 different genealogies and 1 epitaph of sorts.
Yep.
So Exodus 6:20, and this is in the Septuagint version only,
mm-hmm.
Says, and Amram took Jochebed, the daughter of his father's brother, for his own wife. And she bore him both Aaron and Moses and Miriam, their sister. So Exodus 6:20 is naming the parents of Aaron, Moses, and Miriam, mm-hmm. and naming all 3 of them as children, not in order, because Miriam and Aaron yeah. are older than Moses. Yep. Moses is the baby. Numbers 26:59, the name of Amram's wife was Jochebed, daughter of Levi, who was born to Levi in Egypt. And she bore to Amram Aaron, Moses, and their sister Miriam. Similar, right?
Mm-hmm.
1 Chronicles 5:29. I'd be interested in the which source material these come from. I mean,
yeah.
Exodus being Septuagint only may have been seeing it in Numbers and throwing it back where it made sense.
Very possibly, yeah.
Who knows? And then in 1 Chronicles 5:29, in the English versions of this, it's in 6:3. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to go look it up, it's 1 Chronicles 6:3. There's some differing numeration in some of these texts. It's not cause for alarm.
Yeah.
It says the children of Amram, Aaron, Moses, and Miriam mm-hmm. in part of this genealogical mm-hmm. context. Micah 6:4 says, "For I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, and I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam."
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. This is direct speech from God claiming Miriam as an ambassador for God. I sent you Miriam.
Yeah. In the same way that he sent Moses and Aaron.
Yeah. Not in a different, like, and that's what we were talking about with Numbers 12. Hasn't God spoken through me too?
Mm-hmm.
Like, calm down, Moses. Okay.
And that's, maybe I'm not sure what you have for the next part, but that's part of what I alluded to at the beginning of the episode with what Gaffney writes in Daughters of Miriam, is that there's a Miriamic tradition.
Yeah.
And so we know there was someone named Miriam at one point, but there may have been other. So the other Miriams we're seeing, which I know is kind of like brain breaking a little bit, but the other Miriams that get listed, especially if we're looking at like extra biblical mm-hmm. accounts, are within that same tradition of Miriam.
Yeah.
But then that also then establishes Miriam as a prophetic, prophetessic tradition in it of itself.
Yeah.
And so, especially the epitaph in Micah 6:4, but also in Chronicles there too, that is, she is listed alongside them with no distinction as in the same capacity.
Right.
So you can't, not only is she listed as a prophet in Exodus 15, but we have actual extant biblical texts that put her on the exact same footing as Moses and Aaron.
This one I think is really interesting in Pseudo-Philo as well. Pseudo-Philo 20.8, again, sometimes abbreviated as LAB. It says, "And these are the three things that God gave to his people on account of three persons. That is, the well of the water of Mara for Miriam, and the pillar of cloud for Aaron, and the manna for Moses. And when these came to their end, these three things were taken away from them." So I think that's really interesting. Pseudo-Philo is connecting, reading the story and connecting these three individual people to three very important survival aspects in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And when Miriam goes, the waters of Mara go. When Aaron goes, the pillar of cloud goes. And when Moses goes, the man is gone too. That there's, it's really interesting to me. But I think it's a great tradition too, that she's tied to something life-giving.
Yeah.
For the Israelites in their wilderness wandering. And then just briefly, some legendary material that has also sprung up around her. These are all going to be from Louis Ginsburg's Legends of the Jews. I just pulled some snippets from here. So, due to the merits of Miriam, a mysterious well created on the eve of the first Sabbath accompanied the children of Israel in the desert. I'm assuming waters of Mara might be connected to that.
Yeah, probably.
Miriam's death plunged all into deep mourning. Moses and Aaron wept in their apartments, and the people wept in the streets, which is interesting, in the streets in the wilderness where they're wandering, whatever. Okay. For 6 hours, Moses was ignorant of the disappearance of Miriam's well with Miriam's death.
Mm.
Besides the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, only Moses, Aaron, and Miriam breathed their last in this manner through the kiss of the Shekinah. And these six, together with Benjamin, are the only ones whose corpses are not exposed to the ravages of the worms, and they neither corrupt nor decay.
Mm.
Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Aaron, Moses, Benjamin, and Miriam.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One woman.
Yeah.
Chills. When he, Moses, spoke of the remarkable death that awaited Aaron, Moses meant to allude to the fact that Aaron, like his sister Miriam and later Moses, was to die not through the angel of death, but by a kiss from God. This mountain was divided among four kingdoms, and each kingdom had a special name for its part. The most appropriate name seems to be Nebo, for upon it died three sinless Nevi'im prophets, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. I feel like I'm giving her eulogy right now.
Yeah.
The altar's height was 3 cubits, corresponding to the three deliverers God sent to deliver Israel from Egypt, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. Okay, so in summary, I have a little summary statement about her. So, Miriam is a prophet and a cultic leader. She is bold, clever, and capable of dealing with the unmerited repercussions of her actions. She is unafraid of approaching and challenging authority. She's caring and nurturing and concerned for the well-being of Moses and Zipporah. Further, she is loved deeply and profoundly by brothers that are willing to take on God to ensure her healing. She's respected and admired by a community that will delay their journey to their promised land for her sake. She is remembered as a sinless prophet worthy of being named alongside Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But the most striking thing about Miriam is simply that she is remembered. Her stories could easily have been ignored or recast. Instead, multiple traditions have developed and her legacy is felt today as, quote, her story and the interwoven stories of the women around her form the basis of a resurgence within Judaism. And that's a guy named Schwartz, and all the women followed her. Hmm. So, yeah, it's a big deal that she's remembered. Not a lot of women are. Yeah. Not by name. There aren't a lot of named women.
No.
And there's a lot of women. Not a lot of them are named. And not a lot of them are leaders. Not a lot of them are remembered for anything other than sexual malfeasance or mm-hmm. sexual assault upon their bodies.
Yeah.
Or sexual difference. They, mm-hmm. They're prostitutes.
Right, right.
Sex workers. They are conning their father-in-laws into having sex with them so they can have children. So there are lots of things striking about the fact that she's remembered and how she's remembered. So I think Miriam is pretty cool lady.
Central figure of Judaism.
Yeah, very central figure. And I think that's something that does get lost a little bit in some Protestant traditions. I mean, in part because, you know, the Hebrew Bible is ancillary to the New Testament for Protestant traditions. And
yeah.
When it gets pulled in, you know, if it's in your lectionary reading, if you're going to choose between a gospel and a Hebrew Bible text, you're probably going to choose the gospel. And so you're going to get a whole different set of Mary / Miriams there. But I don't think it's coincidental that the mother of Jesus is named after Miriam.
It's part
There's
of
something
the,
there.
Part of the tradition.
Part of the tradition. So anyway, that's a little bit about Miriam. She's pretty cool. You should listen to her some.
Super rad.
She's super rad. She's got some cool stuff to say. She's not nearly as humble as Moses, but I mean, who can be?
Who wants to be?
Quote Moses. She's not as humble as I am, but I still like her. Anyway, I think that's it for us today.
That's it.
Yeah. Amen and see you all, guys.